The Tom Woods Show, episode 782.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I've just released another free ebook, this one called Education Without the State. Grab your copy at nostateeducation.com or by texting the word educate to 33444. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm talking today to another professor who's gotten himself in trouble with the social justice warriors. I'm going to let him tell the story. It's Professor Anthony Esselin of Providence College, where he teaches Renaissance English literature and the development of Western civilization. Professor Esselin holds his bachelor's degree summa cum laude from Princeton University and got his PhD at the University of North Carolina. He's best known for his widely acclaimed translation of Dante's Divine Comedy. He's also the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Western Civilization and Life Under Compulsion, 10 Ways to Destroy the Humanity of Your Child, among other books. Now, I want to tell you, this is one of my favorite conversations I've had on this show. And it's true that at times we talk about some Catholic topics. I know not all my listeners are Catholic, but I know some of them at least are curious about those sorts of things. Don't let that make you say, I don't want to listen to this. You're going to want to listen through the whole way. Because if you're like me, and frankly, if you're not at least a little like me, why would you be listening to the show? You're going to say, I'm glad I was present for this. It's a really, really great discussion. So I'm going to turn things over to my conversation with Anthony Esselin. All right, let's talk about what's been going on with you at Providence College. I've long respected you from a distance, and I think, I don't even remember what episode it was. Maybe I was talking to Brad Berzer. It was. I was talking to Brad Berzer, and we were talking about the Divine Comedy, and we all said that people should read your translation. Ever since then, I thought, I should have this guy on the show. Little did I know it would be under these circumstances. Can you describe what's been going on?
Oh, dear. Well, first of all, thanks to Brad Berzer for that plug. It buys a few pizzas at the Esselin household.
Right.
Well, in recent years at Providence College, I think the Catholic faculty have felt themselves increasingly in the minority, that is, the faithful Catholic faculty, for whom the Catholic mission of the college really means a lot. And they've been the subject of some pretty severe attacks from their secular colleagues. I mean attacks that might jeopardize their careers. And I'm growing tired of it and have had, frankly, enough of it. And so I wrote a couple of articles, one in the spring, one this fall, on basically what it is that we mean by diversity, and what that has to do with a classical liberal arts education and the Catholic character of the college, the Catholic faith. The odd thing of it is that as a Roman Catholic, I belong to the most culturally diverse institution in the history of the world. But secular people, I think, don't understand that. They don't know what's going on or what has gone on in the Catholic faith for 2,000 years. So they view everything in the light of current American politics, and it's hard for us to talk the same language when Catholics try to view everything in the light of the history of salvation and eternity. So anyway, I wrote these two articles, and I've come under fire for, it's the usual accusations. I'm this, that, and the other that's evil, and I've had students protesting, and the president of the college singled me out in front of the whole student body and the faculty for reproach. I mean, basically, I've been called a racist and a sexist and a this and that ist, and it's been kind of ugly.
Well, you know, it's easy when you're on the sidelines and you're not involved and you see somebody else being accused of these names and you think, boy, you know, that's when you're called those names these days, it's almost always a medal on your chest. It just means that you were just doing your job as a scholar. It's easy to say that when you're on the sidelines, but when you're involved in it and it's an attack on you at an institution where you've poured 20 years of your life, I suppose, it must not be so easy.
Yeah, 27 years.
Wow, 27.
Yeah, this is my 27th year.
Now, have you always had a decent rapport with the other faculty?
Well, yeah, until, I would say until the last maybe 2 years or so. Now, see, at Providence College, we have this 2-year-long Development of Western Civilization program that all freshmen, all sophomores have to take, okay? And it's been a little bit watered down for the non-honors students, but basically it covers in 4 semesters the whole history of the West, a wide variety of cultures. It's taught by teams of professors, so you get different disciplines, philosophy, theology, history, literature, and art lectures and music lectures when we can smuggle them in. And this has been under attack at Providence College from the secular left, especially in the social sciences, for 35, 40 years. And I've seen it in my own person, right, for the last quarter century, a little bit more. And, you know, this is just one continuing battle. So if you defend that program vocally, right, loudly, you will be accused by certain professors in the social sciences, a few very loud professors in social sciences. So you're going to accuse you of being all those nasty things just because you defend a program in which they say students read dead white males. I mean, that's a language that is foul in my mouth. But they are the ones who talk that language. So that's part of this fight here. The fight for the Catholic identity of the college is all tangled up with how we value what used to be called a liberal arts education, a classical liberal arts education. So the battle lines kind of form along those issues.
Well, why don't we get into the specifics of what you said in the article that caused so much offense? Did you think it would ruffle these feathers? I mean, it could well be that you probably figured a lot of these people don't even read the sorts of websites and publications that you and I would write for.
Yeah, well, I'm writing for Crisis Magazine, so I'm writing for an Orthodox Catholic audience. I figure that nobody here but maybe 2 or 3 Catholic professors is going to read an article like that. I don't know how the students got hold of it. I don't think really that the students understood what I was getting at.
Oh, you think? really?
Yeah, you know. One of the points that I make in the article is that I'm actually a great believer in cultural diversity. I think I believe in it more ardently than they do, because I believe in the study of a wide variety of cultures, and you're going to get that variety these days. Not in the current world, where everything is being homogenized. You're going to get it from the study of the past. And it's very precious, and not to let these past cultures be forgotten, but to learn from them, both their successes and their mistakes. I mean, here's this professor, right? I stumble around in 10 languages, but I'm called xenophobic, you know? I spend my summers in a part of the world, French Canada, where, well, I'm in a foreign country among people who don't speak English as their first language, but I get called xenophobic. It doesn't make any sense. So it's very strange. So you get people on the social science side saying, we need cultural diversity, but all they really study is current events from the point of view of a secular Westerner, right? How is that an experience of diversity? That's one of the questions I'm asking in the article. Another question is, how can you be talking about diversity when you want this college, this Catholic college, to be like every other college? Isn't it a celebration of diversity to have colleges be distinct? I don't tell other colleges what they have to teach, but why should Providence College be just like them, right? But they have no answers to this, really, because, well, I think if you're a secular, your ceiling is actually pretty low.
So that's the what you've been focusing on, or one of the points in your article, is that the current day obsession with bean counting ethnic diversity is like a secular. It interferes with the type of unity that the Catholic world, which of course the word Catholic means universal,
right,
is ultimately striving for, and that unity points toward eternity, whereas the current fake unity is extremely present oriented and tied up in politics and ephemeral.
Yes, all that, and I will just add that in the unity of the Catholic Church, there is no homogenization. There's no reduction of everybody to the same sort of global standard. The saints are sharply distinct from one another, and the Catholic Church has been an uplifter, an elevator, a purifier, but and a preserver of cultures. This is the great missionary problem: how to bring the Catholic faith to a culture that's very different from your own. And the Catholic answer has consistently been to purify that culture, to respect what is good in it and beautiful, and to celebrate that, not to make everybody into Englishmen or everybody into Italians, but to make them more themselves than they perhaps ever were. That's part of it too. But that is something also that the secular people would not be able to see.
So you say that the administration has been unfriendly and there have been protests. What else, if anything, has gone on? And do you feel comfortable on campus? Have they created a hostile work environment for you?
Yes, I think they have. I think they've intended to. Certainly, if you want to make somebody comfortable on campus, you don't do what was done to me. The faculty met with the president a week or so ago and had a 60-minute hate fest. And another letter went out from one of the vice presidents of the college that was as damning or even a little bit more damning than the letter that that came out from the president was. So I basically, I've been singled out. I've had a bullseye painted on my back for the crime of, as I believe it, actually believing in diversity in ways that my opponents do not understand. The students are caught in the crosshairs here because I think that they are just being used as political players. The students don't have the big picture. They're too young. They don't have the experience yet, right? They're easily led. They're young, you know. They're full of energy. They want to go forth and promote something, and they want to feel that they're part of something big, some cause or other. And they can be used by professors who have political agendas. And unfortunately, that has happened here. It's not a pretty sight.
But what could be bigger than defending Western civilization, for heaven's sake? At what point are some students going to wake up and say, if I want to belong to something bigger than myself, how about that?
They've been told that that all of Western civilization has been one long miserable tale of oppression. It's the strangest thing, you know.
Have they visited a lot of African countries, these kids?
No, they haven't.
Yeah. Okay.
No, and they'd be shocked to find out that a person like me holds out very dear hopes that Africa will end up being the salvation of the world. When the whole Western world goes insane, Africa will pull the world back to sanity. They wouldn't get that at all. They wouldn't understand what I was talking about at all. I'm talking mainly about faculty members here and not about students. Faculty don't necessarily have a very broad education in the liberal arts.
Oh, that's an interesting thing to say. Are you talking about faculty who are in other disciplines or faculty within the liberal arts?
Well, sometimes it's faculty in the liberal arts themselves. Less so here than at most places. But the strange thing is that even in the faculty in the liberal arts at most American colleges right now do not have a particularly broad education. You can't even depend upon it. Let's say that you have an English professor teaching at land-grant state university someplace in the U.S. Does that English professor have a broad and deep knowledge of English literature? Okay. And the answer to that question is maybe yes, maybe no. It's a toss-up. Maybe it's even worse than a toss-up, that it's actually more likely that that professor of English does not have a broad education in English literature. And then forget about it once you leave that department. All right. So education has become increasingly specialized and narrow.
What do you think happens next for you now?
Oh, I don't know. I've been denied the chance to write to all of the students directly to make a plea. I've appealed to them through the student newspaper. It's been the only avenue open to me. So we'll see. I plan to give a talk on Christ and the meaning of cultural diversity in coming weeks. Maybe I had wanted to give it today. I was told that if I tried to give it, maybe the students would shut it down. I don't think that that's actually going to happen. I would like to say to them things that they've never heard before, you know, and welcome them into this this great education that we have to offer them, and not to have their heads turned by campus politicians who have not had this education, don't really know, in their own persons, don't really know how to value it because they've never experienced it.
You could make a YouTube video that wouldn't, it's true, be emailed to every student. I guarantee you that thing would get around because at the very least, Crisis Magazine would pick it up,
right,
which means the campusreform.org would pick it up, which means the same way they found out about your article, they'd find out about the video.
Now, that is a thought. I had not thought about that.
That's what I'm here for.
There you go, yeah. I had not thought about that. That might be, yeah, let me
because
think that
at the
over.
At the very least, it rallies the whole country to your side, even if it accomplishes nothing at Providence College.
Yeah, which would be very unfortunate as far as Providence College is concerned. You know, we never did lose our Catholic identity. And in many ways, it's a really good college. I used to say, until about a year or so ago, I said all the time to anybody who asked me, I said that I thought that I had the best academic job of anybody that I knew in the United States because I got to teach at a Catholic college that affirmed my freedom. I got to teach Homer, Augustine, Aquinas, Milton, Rembrandt, Shakespeare, Johann Sebastian Bach, Dante, you name it. I got to teach all these wonderful things to all these cheerful young people, okay? And I could speak my mind. Not that I don't politicize in classes at all, and I don't, you know, I don't hide the fact that I'm Roman Catholic, but I have freedom to talk about anything. I didn't have to worry. Until about a year or so ago. We'll see how this shakes out. My colleagues who do teach in philosophy and theology have been under the gun for a little bit longer because they, you know, I mean, they're really out in the line, right? They've got to teach Catholic teachings and, you know, that most of the secular faculty finds those teachings abominable.
Now, what about the possibility? This depends, of course, on your tolerance level for abuse, which may be low.
Yeah.
But have you considered taking the offending articles you wrote and, in light of your experiences, developing a whole book out of it, doubling down on it?
No, I haven't thought about that yet. The strange thing about all of this is that I know very well that if I could have students in small groups, because when you're a big group, the big group dynamic then takes over. But if I can talk to any students about anything. It's faculty that are hardened in their ideologies. Students are fine, you know. If I could have the opportunity to speak to them, okay, then all this would become very different, right? But you know, they're being encouraged by people from the outside not to talk to me. They have a Facebook page calling for boycotts of my classes. My gosh, I mean, I have wonderful things to teach these kids. All I have to do is come and ask, you know, just right there, and it's not going to hurt me personally. It just hurts them. So the people who are urging them to do this don't have their best interests in mind.
And unfortunately, as you say, what a narrow, in fact, narrow is just not a good enough word here, stilted, I can't quite come up with the word, way to look at the world, that all you can do when looking at the world or history or other cultures is to view everything through a 21st century left liberal lens in left liberal categories. You can't even understand other people for all their talk about diversity. How could they understand almost any of the other cultures of the world if all they can think about is gender oppression?
Yeah, well, that's one of the beauties of studying ancient cultures and medieval cultures and Renaissance cultures. You're forced out of your grid, right, the current political grid. And then, well, yeah, I mean, that's the great beauty of a liberal arts education. It liberates you. I mean, Newman said this. All the great thinkers about liberal arts education in the last 150 years said the same thing. It liberates you from the narrow confines of your own place, your own time, even your own culture. And that is all to the good. And that, of course, is what I have to offer all kids here, right? I mean, I don't care who comes to my office wanting this sort of education. I welcome everybody. Right? I'm not the one who thinks in terms of ethnicity and the other stuff. They are. I mean, the irony is just incredible.
You have a book called, among your many books, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Western Civilization.
Right.
And that's, of course, a series of books I've contributed to. Now, in that book, you teach a lot of things that, as you say, the typical college student, or even in some cases college professor, has not learned. Now, when I usually encounter defenses of Western civilization against leftist attacks, the defenses very often take the form of defending Enlightenment views as if the Enlightenment is Western civilization,
and then
they go and smack down the left that way.
Right.
What's your approach?
Well, the Enlightenment is a narrow slice of Western civilization and in many ways not a particularly nice one. When we teach Western civilization, we go back all the way. Some of the teams in our Western civilization program go all the way back to the Babylonians to pick up the Epic of Gilgamesh and then begin to compare it with the very different Book of Genesis. We take them all the way back, at least to the ancient Hebrews, perhaps even beyond the ancient Hebrews. So our students, by the time they get to the Enlightenment, our students should have a fund of knowledge about the world before, so that Enlightenment pretenses will ring a little bit hollow. You know, I mean, what's the great art that the Enlightenment produced? Okay, we got Beethoven, we got some pretty good poetry, but generally when it comes to that sort of thing, the Enlightenment is rather thin. The thinking in the Enlightenment is rather narrow. It's philosophy in any case. And the students, we hope the students will be able to see around it, beyond it, right? Something other than it. It's got its limitations, but if that's what you mean by Western civilization, the Enlightenment, that's very little. That's pretty narrow.
What's wrong then with the typical student view of the way Western civilization has gone? That okay, we had backward superstitious people for 1700, 1800 years, and then all of a sudden people threw this off and said, this is nonsense. We need science and microscopes and magnifying glasses. What's wrong with that?
Well, first of all, what's wrong with that is somebody who talks that way really doesn't know what they're talking about. They have no great knowledge of the ancient world, the Middle Ages, the Renaissance. They have at best a comic book set of bigotries about that, as you said, you know, is 1700 years of ignorance. It's crazy. All I have to do is to say to people, look, all right, I'm going to show you the greatest folk art in the history of the world. That is folk art. It comes from the lived experience of the people. It's produced by very ordinary people, many of whom do not know how to read, okay? Yet it expresses their loves and their deepest longings as people. They are the Gothic cathedrals that are spread all over Europe during the High Middle Ages. That is folk art. So there you have the greatest folk art in the history of the world by far, I think, and the arguably the most beautiful buildings that mankind has ever produced, right? More beautiful in the Middle Ages before the Industrial Revolution put a lot of grime on their outside. So these places shone like jewels, right? And so you're telling me that that whole era is to be dismissed. It's the era that invented the university system, right? That you supposedly love so much. What do you think, that it was invented during the time of Immanuel Kant? I can just point over and over. If these people were such dummies, how come they produced what Henry Adams said, okay? And he wasn't even a believer. If these times were so dark, how come they produced 4/5 of the world's greatest art? That's Henry Adams. I don't know that I would go so far as to say 4/5, but you see the argument, right? How come they produced people whose names are Dante, Thomas Aquinas, Chaucer, Bernard of Clairvaux, and so on, okay? I mean, the people who talk as if the West began with the Enlightenment are just ignorant.
But unfortunately, I think that's the view that not only the left has of, well, you have different kinds of the left. You have the left that is anti-Enlightenment in some ways. You have the left that is pro-Enlightenment, and you have the right that thinks that the Enlightenment is all there is to Western civilization. And then you have like a small sliver of people who actually are interested in all of Western civilization. Not to say that everything in it is defensible,
right?
But to say that it began in the 18th century and Voltaire is one of the great figures of all history is extremely impoverished, to put it mildly.
Right. I mean, Voltaire of all people, too, who wrote one half-decent book. I wouldn't trade one paragraph of Thomas Aquinas or one canto of Dante's Divine Comedy for all of the collected works of Voltaire, a narrow and somewhat bigoted man. The funny thing is that the people on the right who think they are conservative, whose ideas of Western civilization spring almost completely from the Enlightenment, they are what they actually are: classical 19th century liberals, right? The true conservative sees the limitations of 19th century liberalism that now goes by the name of conservatism. So there are people like Russell Kirk and all that who want to recover the whole breadth and depth of Western civilization, which of course includes the Hebrew scriptures, right, which don't come from Europe at all, but from Asia, the Near East. That part, I suppose, is an in-house fight on the right, but, you know, it does frustrate me, too, to hear people on the so-called right talking as if they were coming right out of a salon in Paris in 1780.
And yet, the interesting thing is that when you look at Russell Kirk's political views and what he's calling for in a program for conservatives, and he even wrote a book on economics that's basically pretty laissez-faire.
Yeah.
The political program he favors is not altogether – it's not a million miles away from what a 19th century liberal would favor.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of blame him for that. I don't know. Economics is not my strong suit, so I sit on the fence there. I know that that wouldn't please my friends at the Acton Institute. I remain unpersuaded of the 19th century liberal case, which is now conservative, for laissez-faire economics.
This would have been a good conversation.
Yeah, yeah. My great man Charles Dickens was no fan of it.
Oh yeah, but no. I can't start in on Charles. Yeah, he was. No. He was just such a horrible moralizer. No. I can't do this. But you know, the thing is, I have a lot of friends in the. Well, I don't know if they would. I think of myself as their friend. I don't know how they feel about me. But you know, for a long time I wrote for the traditional Catholic press. So Crisis Magazine we would have viewed as squishy. You know, that was how we were, right? Well, Crisis Magazine, what's the matter? But they, a lot of them, not all, but a lot of them just couldn't take, because I do basically favor laissez-faire economics. But instead of this being a, well, look, let's talk this out. We're all friends. Let's try and talk this out. It really became like an excommunication. But at least they didn't excommunicate me the way there were no protests. There were no bullhorns. Yeah. There was no, you know, it was just, we'd rather that you not publish with us anymore. And if that's the way people want to disagree with each other, I'm totally all in favor of that. But yeah. I know that group of people. I understand what their arguments are. And for people listening who have heard, I wrote a book called The Church and the Market that was really not aimed at socialists. It really was aimed at traditional Catholics who have a different criticism. They're not critiquing the market economy for the reasons that, you know, Hillary Clinton might.
Right.
It's a much more, and I'm much more sympathetic to their arguments, which is why I wanted to take them seriously. Whereas most of the time, as you probably know, if you're right of center and you're skeptical of the market economy, you get treated like you're Bernie Sanders. And that's not what you're saying. And it's not what you're.
No, not at all. This should be a cordial, a very cordial, friendly in-house discussion among Catholics about just what it is that a free economy is supposed to provide. And I think the church does teach that there ought to be very broad freedoms in the economy, right? I mean, I find that in the writings of Pope Leo XIII, who I wrote a book about. And yet we always have to ask the question that an ideologue would not want to ask, which is exactly how does this policy here play itself out in terms of the human good, in terms of the common good. And that may differ, actually, from place to place and time to time, from situation to situation. But those are questions that deal with pragmatics and less with ideology. So though I am very sympathetic to the Acton Institute, and I hope they hire me, actually. I've got that distributist part of me too, from Chesterton and Belloc and the others. And I just want to keep asking the question, in these particular circumstances, what economic policy should we follow in order to produce the good society, to bring about the common good? I don't think that that's a question that can be answered in the abstract. I think it has to be rooted in time and place. But that's an argument that we can have amongst ourselves.
Yeah, and I always wanted to have that discussion. I really did, because I thought that would be fruitful and it would force me to think a little bit harder about a lot of things. And unfortunately, I was just more or less expelled from that particular group. And a guy I had once written a book with wrote an entire book denouncing me. And a whole book. So in a way, I was flattered that I was worth a whole book.
Who was that?
Chris Ferrara. Does that name ring a bell?
Yeah.
All right. So let's not. I don't want to. Yeah. Look, I'm not about personalities here on the show. I really am about the ideas. And so,
that's a shame. That's a shame. A Robert Sirico and a Dale Alquist should be able to talk to each other. We should all be able to talk to each other about these things, because basically,
yeah,
we all believe the same things, right? If we're Catholics and we're interested in politics, economics, and the common good, we basically agree on what this life is all about, where it's aimed. We have broad agreement on what actually constitutes the common good. Okay, then our question is how do you practically achieve it? How do you bring it about? And as I say, I mean, those are questions that deal with pragmatics and situations. We've got to see. But that should be a very friendly argument. What's going on here is not a friendly argument.
No, it's not. I mean, I wouldn't want to be attacked by the left. At this point in my career where I'm not beholden to anybody and I don't earn a regular paycheck from anybody, it doesn't matter. It only elevates my profile. So in a way, it's fine. It's no problem for me. But I remember what it was like collecting a paycheck and having major newspapers denounce my politically incorrect book because it said all kinds of forbidden things. And what's interesting was just like in your case, they didn't actually correct me. They didn't say, this is a factual error Woods makes, and we're going to correct him. It was, how dare he say this? It was that kind of approach. But then going back just for a second to the traditional Catholic press, the bizarre thing about this, of course, is that, this all took place pretty much at the end of John Paul's pontificate and during Benedict. And when Benedict became Pope, I think a lot of Orthodox Catholics breathed a bit of a sigh of relief, like, okay, things are somewhat normal now in the Catholic world. Maybe normality will be restored. But frankly, and I don't expect you to comment on this, but frankly, in the Catholic world of Pope Francis, the idea that a free market Catholic is your biggest enemy is absurd. You know, the idea that I would be expelled, not that I'm particularly keen on getting back in, but you know, see what I mean? This is ridiculous. You can't pick your battles.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, no, that's... Yeah. Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Anyway, boy.
And you know what I always say to faithful Catholics and faithful Christians of other communions? I say all the time, and this comes from my experience at Touchstone Magazine, which is edited by Catholics and Eastern Orthodox and conservative Protestants. I say, look, you know, we got a whole lot of enemies out there that just want to crush us. Right, they don't want to hear anything about Christianity at all. There's just stuff out there. There's a lot of bad stuff out there, and a lot of harmful stuff for humanity. Aim your guns at that. Don't aim your guns at each other. What do I care if the uniform of the guy whose rifle is aimed in the same direction that my rifle is aimed, his uniform is a little bit different from mine. I'll let the captain, Jesus Christ, sort that out in the end. But he's my ally. Anybody right now who is resisting the secular imperialism of the West, right? And that person, to that extent, is my ally. If he's a Christian, he believes in Christ, he's really my ally. He's my brother. That Catholics who are Orthodox should be denouncing one another because of differences of opinion on such a thing as economics, that's appalling to me. That's absolutely appalling.
I want to make sure and link on the show notes page. So this is episode 780. I've already forgotten, 782. So tomwoods.com/782. I will link to, I want people to be able to read the articles that you wrote that caused all this ruckus, because I want them to see, I want them to read them and then say, that's it? That's what led people to protest?
I know.
People have got to see this.
They're very mild, and the students are hardly in them at all. They're mainly aimed at faculty members, and they ask questions about what we mean by diversity. The questions that nobody asks, so I ask them.
Yeah. The sorts of things you're supposed to – I feel silly even saying this anymore. The sorts of questions you're supposed to ask when you're in college. You're supposed to be open-minded and open to – boy, what a farce that turned out to be, unfortunately. What a shame. But
yeah, well, you know, this is part of the problem when you have – I mean, we believe in the three-person God. We're oriented towards eternity. If you lack that – then current politics takes over, I think, and it becomes of ultimate concern. It becomes a matter of life and death. You know, when there are 50 things more important in any given day than current national politics, that or should be in your life. One of the cures for being really upset about the recent election is to go to church, but they don't have that available to them. You know, that's too bad. And so, and when they get to college, they're not grounded enough to be able to ask questions that would change their points of view about these secondary matters like politics, because it's been elevated to a religion.
Well, and that's just it, because it's not a secondary matter to them.
Yeah,
so
no,
they can't compute. This is everything to them,
right.
And they have made it into a kind of a god. And before we went on, I said it would be like if Lady Gaga somehow became Pope. It would totally disorient the Catholic world. No one would really be able to understand. It would be hard to make sense of your life in those circumstances. And even crazier when you make the state into your ultimate and this result happens, of course, all there can be is wailing and gnashing of teeth. And I just today I saw somebody on Facebook, a leftist, saying, well, you know, I've been apathetic up to now, but now I'm going to get involved. And of course, what does get involved mean? Wave signs, sign petitions, call your congressman. And I said, there's so many other much vastly more meaningful ways to, quote, get involved, where you would really influence and help people and change people's lives. And all you can think of is signing a darn petition.
I know. Yeah. You love mankind, do the dishes.
Yeah, exactly right.
Actually do something good for somebody today. And maybe start cleaning up your own life, you know? Because your life is probably a mess. Everybody's a sinner, after all. But when politics is your god, then you can project onto your political opponents every evil. Right. You don't have to look in the mirror and say, you know what, I'm actually kind of a rat. I say bad things about my enemies. I tell lies. I waste my time. I click on things online that I shouldn't be looking at. There are a whole lot of things about me that need purifying, that I need to atone for, to confess. Well, you don't have to do any of that. If politics is your god, all you have to have is the right. You have to check the right items on a list of political opinions.
Exactly.
And if you do that, then you are justified. You are righteous, and so you can treat your enemies with contempt. You can do anything you please, right? But then when you become disappointed by political events, what's left? It's like the world has come to an end. It's crazy.
And of course, we'll close this, but this is sort of the reason that it's impossible to imagine the most – I'm talking about the sort of leftists who shout down speakers. I'm not talking about a thoughtful person
right.
who happens to be on the left. I mean, you know, we know it's a dwindling breed, but we know some of those people.
Right.
My old dissertation director used to be the provost at Columbia, Alan Brinkley. I classify him that way. He knew I had different views from him, and he was an excellent dissertation director for me.
Right.
But I'm talking about the really, really hostile ones. This is why it's impossible to imagine them sitting down and really trying to have a meeting of the minds with somebody who disagrees with them, because politics is their ultimate, they view this is where good and evil meet. This is Manichaeanism. So if you are opposed to me, you are evil.
Yeah.
You don't have a perspective. I don't sit down with Satan and say, well, what do you think about such and such? What do you think about our highway policy? I wouldn't even think to do that. And so likewise, that can't happen. And again, it's because this sacralizing of the secular has taken place. You can't even meet each other on common ground and say, let's try and talk about our differences. That can't even happen.
Right. No, can't. It's a cosmic battle, right? In the recent unpleasantness that is finally over, Deo gratias, alleluia. You would not even be able to say, right? Supposing that you believed this, but you wouldn't be able to say to them, look, we got two buffoons running for president. Okay, I mean they would rebel against that. What do you mean? You know, it's as if you would offend them by shrugging and taking politics lightly. Now, of course, it can't be taken that lightly either. It does have consequences for human life, for our life in the United States. But in a certain sense, it's healthy to take it lightly, because there are infinitely more important things. So if you laugh at their political preoccupations, they'll get very angry. But they need to be. They need to hear that laughter. I mean, come on. You got somebody hyperventilating because the election went in the opposite way from what he wanted. Is that really a sign of somebody who's healthy? Isn't that, you know, ipso facto a sign of somebody who's got his priorities mixed up? They you know, that don't see it. Oh, my gosh, it's holy water and all the sacraments put together for them.
Well, everybody, I want you to go to the show notes page for this episode, tomwoods.com/782, read the articles we've been talking about. And while you're at it, although Tony has a lot of books, pick up his translation of the Divine Comedy, because that's a way. Could there be a more delicious rebuke of the present American political system than to withdraw and simply read Dante? You know, right? Go and do that and read it with a beautiful translation that you will love and you'll learn a tremendous amount from. Well, best of luck, Tony. I hope everything turns out well. You know, you deserve the best possible resolution, and I hope that comes. And think about that YouTube video.
Thank you, Tom. I think that is a great idea. That is a great idea. People have not gotten it into their heads. I guess I haven't gotten into my head. You know, right now we've got ways of getting ideas out there.
We do. See, when you're like me and you're a freelancer for a living, you learned that a long time ago. If I don't use my ways, I got nothing. So glad to help. All right. Thanks again, Tony.
Thanks, Tom.
All right. Before I let you go, I want to remind you about the contest I'm holding. My Liberty Classroom affiliate contest. You bring in sales of Liberty Classroom during the days of this contest, and not only am I going to give you the usual 50% commission, which is a lot of money, by the way, but if you're one of my top 10 affiliates, I'm going to give you an extra cash prize on top of that. And if you're my number one affiliate, I'm going to give you a brand new car. Now, come on, this is an easy way. I mean, you have some libertarian friends on social media. This is an easy way to earn some dough off them. You know, I mean, what have they done for you lately? Just hanging around, sitting there, not liking anything you post, not commenting. At least earn a few bucks off them, right? This is an easy way to do that by introducing them to a product they're going to love. So check out woodscontest.com. Make sure you're participating in this thing, woodscontest.com. Absolutely worth the 3 seconds it's going to take you to look that over and see how to be part of this. So check it out, because it's coming up later this month, November 2016. So you want to get into that contest. Check it out at woodscontest.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.